You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Tuesday, July 24th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, helping us set the table for that lame duck session and beyond, the Uber blogger, Digby, from Hullabaloo, or Digby's blog, when I can't pronounce Hullabaloo. Also on the program today, trillions of dollars in offshore tax havens across the world. Was Mitt Romney one of those guys? Undoubtedly. Also, a heartwarming story of someone, using their guns for self-protection. And meanwhile, Colorado gun sales surge. Because they all want to be that guy in the movie theater who's going to be able to take out that crazy gunman. New poverty numbers coming out shortly, sure to show us at a highest level of poverty in decades. Meanwhile, the drought continues in the middle of this country, in Mexico, and around the world. Visions of our future. Emails coming out showing that SB 1070, you know how ridiculous it was to suggest that this was born of some type of racist intent? Well, it is. And the NSA, well, they don't admit, but the FISA court admits they have at least on an occasion broken that, what was that thing called? Oh, the Constitution. And we only know that because the NSA allowed for us to know that, though they deny it. And Mitt Romney's new ad out suggesting that the notion that businesses don't get a hand from the government features a business owner of a business which got a big hand from the government. Somebody's not doing their vetting properly. Before we get to Digby, a couple of announcements. First off, I am going to be at the Impact Fest moderating a conversation with several folks, including Rob Johnson, Chris Hedges, and others. We will post information on the site. It's tomorrow night at the Culture Project. So if you're in New York and you're interested, be sure to check it out. You can get free tickets by typing the word SUNK, S-U-N-K, at the checkout for the link that we will provide for you on the site. Matt, Michael, I was already going to get you guys free tickets, so don't even bother. Save your keystrokes. A couple of things I want to highlight for you. At rampscampaign.org, People are gathering in West Virginia tomorrow. RAMPS is hosting a mobilization where people will prepare to and take nonviolent direct action to shut down a strip mine. So if you're interested and you're in that neighborhood, I don't know if you saw the last mountain. It is unbelievable the devastation created by this strip mining. Devastation not just on our environment, but the people who live in the Appalachians. Also, an email from Alaric Brera, and you can follow him on at Hungerstrike LA. He is on a hunger strike at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. 30 other people are striking with him, according to the email. The Los Alamos National Laboratory is where the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were first created. They have a series of demands, ranging from calling for a meeting with their congressional representative to share concerns and our commitment to progressively transforming all nuclear weapons work at Los Alamos into cleanup, remediation, and other life-affirming scientists. Tweet them for more information. Don't have a site at this time. And also, there is a day of action to raise the minimum wage that is taking place today across the country. You can go to nelpaction.wordpress.com. We will post that link on our site at majority.fm. There are actions taking place all across the country that you can get involved in, including New York City today at 3 p.m., Baltimore, Chicago, Detroit, Houston, Los Angeles, Miami, Milwaukee, Minneapolis, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Portland, Seattle, St. Louis, all across the country. Check out that. Again, the link will be on majority.fm. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Digby. We are back on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome back to this program the Uber blogger at the Uber blog, Hullabaloo, or digbysblog.blogspot.com. Is it still a blogspot?
It is. You know, I'm old school.
I understand. I love it. I still love the old blogspots.
I know there aren't very many of us left, but... Yeah, well, still carrying the torch for the old days.
Indeed, in many ways. so, Digby, there, particularly last week, there were a lot of stories out that the Democrats heading to this so-called fiscal cliff, which I think is just another way, of course, to scare us. It's going to be problematic, but not necessarily in the way that many of the solutions are floated. Would have you believe. The Democrats, at least in terms of the sunsetting of the Bush tax cuts, seem, huge asterisk, seem to have a new strategy that different from the one that they had at least as late as early June. It seems like they're going to allow these to essentially sunset, assuming that the vote tomorrow to get rid of them and just put in a middle class tax cut fails, which I think we believe. Give me your sense of this, and how real do you think it is, and how smart do you think it is?
Well, I've thought they should have done this from the beginning. In fact, one of my main complaints about the strategy of the Democrats and the Obama administration on these tax cuts goes back to the beginning of the Obama administration, in which I felt like they should have extended the middle-class tax cuts as part of the stimulus and just basically gotten that out of the way. Once that was done and you had those in place, you know, extended permanently, then you could you were only dealing with the tax cuts for the rich going forward, which is a much easier lift for the Democrats. I've never understood why they didn't, you know, get that done when they had the majority in the Congress. But in any case, that didn't happen. So now it seems that, you know, they're thinking that what they'll do is let the tax cuts expire on schedule at the first of the year and then come immediately back in with the Obama tax cuts for the middle class, which makes good sense to me. I mean, I have no problem with the idea of you know, forcing the Republicans to vote against tax cuts for the middle class. I think that's a beautiful, you know, tactic to use. And I suspect that the Republicans will not actually, you know, obstruct that. That seems even a bridge too far for them. Could be wrong. And if that's the case, then, you know, then we have a battle royale over tax cuts for the middle class and the Republicans not wanting to give it to them. And that's a reasonable place for us to begin a new conversation about what's really going on in Washington. I don't know how serious the Democrats are. This could be some kind of negotiating position. You know, it's a risky thing to do. The Republicans have shown that they will take things to the very limit, go beyond any reasonable place in negotiations. We saw what they did with the debt ceiling. And they've proven that they are hardcore negotiators. But, you know, I think that it's the smart move for the Democrats, because otherwise we're in a situation where we've got this troop of, you know, centrist and conservative outsiders and insiders who are converging on this idea of enacting Simpson-Bowles, which will, you know, that's far, far worse than allowing the tax cuts to expire and then dealing with the consequences of that.
Yeah, I mean, there has been, there just seems to be an enormous amount, and this is the stuff that basically you just, you know, you get these small pieces on Politico or these, because they're all, it's all happening in the Beltway. You know, every now and then you see some type of op-ed, you know, David Brooksian op-ed talking about some new version of new labels, third way, Americans elect, essentially,
fix the debt.
I mean, it just goes on and on. They all seem to be the same people. They're constantly funded, many of them funded by Pete Peterson. Tell us who Pete Peterson is. And let me just, full disclosure, in the last day that I was on Dylan Radigan's program before it went off the air, I didn't have a tie, and I'd meant to bring one just to show my respects, because I'm no longer wearing ties on TV until maybe in the event someone pays me, I'll do it. But I didn't have a tie. A nice, very well dressed gentleman came in. He was apparently a guest on the show. I didn't know who he was, and he heard me complaining, but I said, "I have an extra tie." He gave me the tie. I wore it. I didn't realize who he was until Radigan was interviewing him. And, you know, also sort of indicative of the sort of this strange sort of political sphere that Radigan inhabited. It turned out to be David Walker.
Oh, my God.
And so I realized I was wearing Pete Peterson's tie. For all intents and purposes.
Oh my God! I hope you can live with yourself.
It was difficult. It felt it tightening itself around my neck.
I imagine
almost automatically as I made it to the room. But tell us who David Walker is, but more importantly, Pete Peterson and his sort of ongoing agenda to cut our Social Security.
Well, Pete Peterson is a major hedge fund manager, master of the universe, who has been around for decades. He was in the Nixon administration. He made billions, literally, in the markets, and he has devoted a good portion of his life and now a big chunk of his fortune to ending Social Security and Medicare. Now, he does this under the auspices of, you know, fixing the deficit for the grandkids and what have you. But, you know, he has been quoted over the years saying things like, we can't afford to have, you know, people spend the last part of their lives on a paid government vacation. So I think we understand where he's coming from. Moreover, when the and this is what I think is the greatest evidence for what his real agenda is. When the government went into surplus under the Clinton administration, Pete Peterson disappeared. He never said a word about shoring up any of the, you know, programs or doing anything like that. He didn't come out for Clinton and Gore's plan to save Social Security first or any of that stuff. He was, you know, right there taking his tax cuts and spending all the money. So anybody who was a deficit hawk who did that, I think, gave the game away. He was there only when there's deficit and only then, you know, talking about major cuts to the safety net programs that, you know, every American benefits from.
To be fair, I think he's on record back in 96 saying that Social Security was in full-on crisis and we need to cut
absolutely.
It to save it.
I mean, he's been saying that since the 70s. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan said it in the 60s that, you know, it was going to be broke by the time the, you know, the man who was then 21 years old was getting ready to retire. I mean, they've never changed their tune about that. And in fairness, I think we have to also say it's not just Republicans or, you know, Wall Street sharks. Plenty of Democrats have done the same thing. Bob Kerry, who's running in Iowa now for, or is it Iowa?
Nebraska.
Nebraska, sorry. He's running for the Senate for Ben Nelson's old seat. In 1999, he said it was clear that by 2012, the entire government would be broke from paying for Social Security. Time is ticking away, but by the election, maybe he'll be proven right. These people have been saying this forever. And, you know, it's never true because it doesn't even make sense. You know, it's theoretically impossible for the government to actually, you know, quote, go broke. It's the entity that prints the money. But nonetheless, this has been going on forever. And these guys just basically have a philosophical, hostility to these safety net programs. So Pete Peterson, having made these billions, and is extremely, unbelievably wealthy, has devoted his life to that. In his retirement, more or less, he has created the Peterson Institute, which is devoted to this cause. And he put $1 billion behind it, and that's a lot of money, even by D.C. standards. So he's paying half of Washington at this point. They're, you know, half of the political establishment is on his payroll to one extent or another, and they're all working in various ways. Now, he's got centrist think tanks like New America Foundation, which I don't think anybody considers to be some kind of a doctrinaire conservative, you know, think tank. It's supposedly nonpartisan, but, you know, they're working night and day on this project. The Center for Responsible Budget, which is run by a woman named Maya McGuinness, she's been on this since the 90s, and she's the one who's behind this latest, you know, they come up with a new slogan every few months. This latest one is Fix the Debt, which now they're bringing in CEOs, which I don't know what the problem is with people in Washington who think that this is the moment to bring in the titans of business in Wall Street to lead us. But
I saw this piece, I mean, Who is calling these people together? We're talking about the CEO and chairman of Honeywell, the executive chairman of the Eaton Corporation, the Tenneco, Invesco. I mean, this sounds sort of like almost like a parody. Aetna, R.R. Donnelly. I mean, it's. Jamie Dimon is coming in. That's very nice to see that he's coming to our rescue now. But Who is assembling these people? And, you know, this is the interesting thing. This is why I want to talk about this now with you, because here we have a time where virtually nothing can get through Congress, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing. Nobody, there's not, even the policy wonks are basically, this is when they're taking their vacations, because they know nothing is going to get through this Congress. Yet, you've got these CEOs who are ostensibly, incredibly busy, because, you know, you've got to work hard for your $100, $200, $300, $400,000 a day that you get paid. Coming into Washington to fix a problem that supposedly will not get anybody addressed. They're all hoping that they all see this lame duck period as sort of the golden chalice, don't they? Like, this is,
yep,
this is the height of our power, because there is the minimal amount of accountability.
Yep. And yeah, that's absolutely what it is. Now, I, just to go back to your previous question, I don't know who is gathering these people together, but according to Stephen Perlstein in the Washington Post, it's Maya McGinnis at the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, who he says was, quote, nudging it along and pulling it all together. So, you know, whatever that means, I don't know that anybody has that power. But I think that in general, what you're saying is absolutely true. They see this as a moment, and they've actually, and I think it was an accident, but it's wound up, in their view, being a very propitious lame duck in ways that make you shudder when you think about it. That's what this fiscal cliff is all about. You have several elements that are coming together just before and after the election. One is the continuing resolution, which is the ability to keep funding the government. That's what the government shutdown arguments are always about. You know, they don't really have a budget. They haven't agreed on anything, but what normally happens in the government is that they pass this continuing resolution, which allows the government to keep funding while they're arguing over it. Normally, I mean, this happens at, you know, in October of every year, at the end of October. In an election year, it would be pro forma. You wouldn't even think about having this argument while everybody's out campaigning. There is some question as to whether or not that's going to happen this year. That's
now,
number one.
There's two elements about this that we should note. One is the series of continuing resolutions are horrible for the effectiveness of government.
Awful.
Because it makes it impossible for any agencies to do any type of long-range planning, because they have no idea what their budget's going to be. So if they just have this sort of like, okay, you know, keep operating it the same budget for the next 3 months, 6 months, year, whatever it is, without any capacity to know whether or not they're going to be functioning or being able to start programs, or whether they should wrap up programs. And the other element is that this has the potential of being very sticky for Republicans this year, because like you say, this usually is pro forma, but are we going to be? I've seen this story in Roll Call by Stan Collender, where he talks about this could be a problem because the Tea Party may revolt, and I don't know why we call it Tea Party. We just call it most of the Republicans at this point may revolt and force a shutdown, and Boehner's supposedly afraid of it. Do you think this is the case, or is this more just sort of Boehner saying, like, I'm just in charge of these crazy lunatics. You need me. I'm the only thing standing between us and Armageddon.
It's never, you know, it's never clear. And, you know, I would have said always that, of course, this is nonsense and that he's playing a game here. He's negotiating. But, you know, you have to admit, after the debt ceiling last year, it did end up, you know, I think Boehner really did want to make the grand bargain and they wouldn't let him. So it's hard to know. On the other hand, one of the things that Collender said in his article that I thought was quite fascinating is that Boehner and these guys, you know, the right wing of the House Republicans, are trying to put some, you know, they're trying to decouple the continuing resolution from the sequester, which is, I'll explain that in a minute, but that's the defense cuts, and they're talking about taking the defense cuts off the table in order to pass this continuing resolution, which the Democrats are balking at and saying, no way, we're not going to do that. So it could be the Democrats, if the Republicans put a bunch of conditions on this continuing resolution that they find, you know, unacceptable, that the Democrats could be the ones to balk. Now, keep in mind that this is all happening right as the election is happening. So we will have to see whether or not any of this comes to pass. If I had to make a bet, I would say it won't. I think that this is one aspect of the fiscal cliff that I think will probably make it beyond the election. Now, what happens then? They could pass one, you know, a month's continuing resolution, come back in the lame duck and do God knows what. But as far as it happening before the election, that strikes me as a long shot. There's also the debt ceiling, which is, you know, that was one that in the last agreement that they had was a short-term deal, as you recall, and that's going to come up again. And we already know that Boehner and his caucus are saying they absolutely will not raise, you know, blah, 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 raise the debt ceiling without cutting, I don't know, half the government. So there's that. Then at the beginning of the year, you have the Bush tax cuts expiring, and we already talked about the possibilities there. Then you have these budget triggers. That's the sequester.
And this is a function of the last debt ceiling vote. This is
exactly
where they were going to have a super committee, and they were going to get together, and they were going to figure out how they were going to cut everything. And if they achieved $1.2, I think it was, $1 trillion worth of cuts, it would stop the automatic triggers. They didn't. So now we're left with these automatic triggers. What is the amounts and the types of spending that will be cut automatically, supposedly in 2013, I guess just right around the time of the inauguration or re-inauguration, depending on who wins. There's basically two different sort of elements to this, and
yeah,
broadly speaking.
There's $1.2 trillion in cuts. I mean, that's a lot of money, and half of it is defense, and half of it is domestic programs, excluding Social Security and Medicare. So, you know, I don't know. They'll end up ending the FAA and the FDA and, you know, all veterans programs or something. It's very, very steep cuts and completely unacceptable. I don't think anybody ever expected that was going to happen. Let me just say one thing about this. You know, this is all, you know, they created this sequester. They created this budget trigger, and they can uncreate it at any time they want. This was not written, didn't come down from Mount Sinai. It's not an amendment to the Constitution. It is an agreement that they made amongst themselves, and they can agree not to honor it. And that is exactly what is going to happen. This idea that this is all written in stone, that these things are all happening, and it's a horrible catastrophe, and we're all going to go over this cliff if we don't do something, i.e. cut Social Security and Medicare, then the whole world is going to come crashing down, is nonsense. These are all agreements that these people made among themselves to do things at a particular time, and there's no reason that it has to actually happen in that way. So, you know, they are creating a sense of crisis in order to come back into this lame duck session and to do the greatest amount of damage that they can. I reject the whole premise of the fiscal cliff, and I think that, you know, we're all being suckered into this, and we're distracted, you know, with it. Obviously, we've got a major election going on. There's a lot of activity happening in the world. There, you know, the economy is still in a slump. There's lots of things to think about. But this particular thing is happening within the Beltway, amongst the Beltway elites and the political establishment, who are ginning up this crisis, which nobody understands. I mean, just us talking about it, we've probably confused people more than they were before. And at the end of the day, they're going to use this as an excuse to do a whole bunch of things. This is a very bad situation. And, you know, my personal feeling is that we are better off, you know, kind of having a standoff, mm-hmm. and ending up with gridlock, in which they have to continue this, go ahead and lay it off on another few months, just, you know, wait till after the inauguration. I mean, obviously they have to deal with these tax cuts, because that's an automatic, that is for real. I mean, that's in the statute. It expires. I don't have a problem with that. You know, if the Democrats are setting this up to have everything go into gridlock, except and including the Bush tax cuts, and they come back on January 1st and say, okay, we're introducing new tax cuts for the middle class, That's probably the best scenario.
Right.
Because I do not trust any of these people. You've got CEOs, you've got Jamie Dimon, you've got Pete Peterson, you've got the, you know, all the think tanks arrayed, all of whom have been, you know, making the case for decades now that Social Security has to be cut. And let me just make one point clear. In this Social Security cut, what they're probably going to do is reduce the cost of living in a way that sounds very benign. It's not benign. It's going to end up costing, down the road, 90-year-old, mostly women, 10% of their meager income when they're 90 years old. That is a huge, huge, you know, sacrifice on their part. Meanwhile, what they're going to ask in return, if they follow this Simpson-Bowles formula, which seems to be the agreed-upon, very serious people formula, they're going to ask, they're going to, you know, slash income tax rates, which makes absolutely no sense, in return for closing loopholes and doing some other sort of things around the edges, which will not raise any revenue because we all know they, you know, it's a full employment act for tax lawyers and lobbyists. And the only people making sacrifices will be these very elderly people down the road. I'll be one of them. You know, you probably will be too. And the, you know, the billionaires, it's tip money for them at most. And probably not even that. This is no bargain. It's no bargain for the American people if they do this. There's no reason to do it. And the idea that the Democrats are even, you know, considering this whole idea of a balanced approach and we have to, you know, have a grand bargain and everybody's got skin in the game and all that. No. No. That it's not necessary. We don't have to do it. It's absolutely ridiculous. And it's all kind of happening. It seems like it's a runaway train at the moment. So, again, best-case scenario is the Tea Party and the Democrats go to loggerheads and nothing happens at all.
And just so that people know, when you hear the innocuous way that they talk about cutting the cost of living increases will be to chain it to the CPI. Those are the watchwords. When you hear someone saying, we're going to just chain this to the CPI, what they're saying is we're going to cut your benefits. And also, obviously, the same thing with the idea of raising the retirement age. If you add up chaining the CPI and raising the retirement age, you're actually talking about money that will be larger than the cuts. You're actually talking about larger cuts down the road than would be if we did nothing. So we're talking about cuts up to 30% with those different features combined to avoid cuts of 22 to 24% starting in 2031. So that's one thing to keep an eye on. The other thing that seems to, and you touched on this, is this notion of their agreement for these automatic cuts. This is the functional equivalent of me saying on a Friday, I'm going on a diet Monday, come hell or high
exactly.
water. And then Monday comes and I'm just like, I actually think it's probably better for me to start midweek.
But I'm not feeling well today, so I don't think I'll be, you know, I won't
the,
do it.
And the game that's being played here, as far as I can tell, and we already had, I think, Dick Cheney visited Congress last week to come in and tell people, his congressman, like, if you cut $50 billion from the defense budget over the next 10, you know, $50 billion a year for the next 10 years, this is going to leave us, you think we're infiltrated by the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, wait till you see what happens, with these cuts.
Thing you know, the terrorists will be here opening fire in movie theaters or something.
Exactly. And the other half of that, of these $500 billion worth of cuts in of discretionary spending, which would essentially the cuts that we're talking about to defense relative to the same amount of cuts to discretionary spending, it's off the charts in terms of the size and the implications of those cuts to discretionary spending. Is the game that the Democrats are playing right now, and I am projecting upon them the best of intentions, which obviously is a very hairy prospect. But the game that they're playing is that we're going to hold you to the defense cuts because we know that you will not allow for those, and therefore we'll protect the discretionary cuts from happening as well. I mean, the worst case scenario, of course, is if somehow they managed to not have the cuts on defense, if they were decoupled those two sets of cuts, and we were just left with the discretionary cuts. I mean, give me your sense of how that is could play out, or and if you've seen any reporting or any conversations you've had specifically on that notion.
Well, I think that's the strategy. I mean, I think that it was set up to be that, you know, that you couldn't. You either had to go all the way or the whole thing would fall apart because everybody knew. I mean, I don't think anybody doubts that the Democrats would probably in the end allow the discretionary cuts to happen at some level. I mean, they've proven over and over again that, you know, they're the ones who are willing. They want to be the grown-ups in the room and whatever else. So, you know, they'll agree to that. But nobody, I don't think, ever believed that the Republicans would go along with defense cuts. And keep in mind also that we had Leon Panetta come up there and say no defense cuts. So it's not like it's not a bipartisan agreement
right.
on that. So, you know, I think that that's what that whole thing was designed to do, which was, you know, that they were going to offset one another and therefore it wouldn't happen. Now, they thought that this was going to happen in the super committee. You know, I don't know if they ever did, to be honest with you. I mean, I think they thought it might work, but they kind of knew that it probably wouldn't. It shoved everything down the road. Now they want it, you know, now it's after the election and they'll come back and take a fresh look. But those defense cuts are not going to happen, Sam. They're just,
right.
It's impossible to imagine it. No, what they want to do is use all this pressure from the fiscal cliff, I think, to push Simpson-Bowles or, you know, whatever the new branding of Simpson-Bowles is. And that does not include substantial cuts to defense. That is not what that is about. I mean, basically what Simpson-Bowles, what they really want to accomplish with all this is to, you know, cut the safety net programs, cut income tax rates. Now, keep in mind here that one of the most perverse aspects of this whole thing is that they actually want to cut taxes. They want to cut the rates. But what they're saying they're going to do is they're going to close the loopholes and cut, quote, tax expenditures, which are tax incentives, essentially, that are built into the system. And they're going to cut all of those. Well, good luck with that. Because what we see, you know, you've been watching what's happened with Dodd-Frank, right?
Sure.
I mean, this was, you know, I mean, they have been in there with an army of lobbyists to water that thing down to the point where it's almost, you know, it's nearly non-existent. That is what will happen.
We've seen this before.
Tax.
I mean, we've seen this before under Reagan. And, you know, I don't want to be in a position of quoting Gopher to bolster my point. But I was on a Larry Kudlow show with Fred Grandy, a former congressman, Fred Gopher Grandy. And he was on the Hill at that time as a congressman. And he was the one on this show who made the point that the whole idea of that 1986, I think it was, omnibus tax cut that Reagan pushed through was that, well, we're cutting rates, but we're closing the loopholes. And within 3 or 4 years, every single one of those loopholes was back in a piecemeal fashion, because that's a very easy thing to do. It's always easy to create those loopholes because most people don't even understand them. They're done in a very sort of benign, dry way. And ostensibly, they're for middle-class people. I mean, take the home mortgage deduction. This is ostensibly something that puts people into houses, you know, in a cheaper way. But the benefits accrue, of course, more so if you buy a $2 or $3 or $4 or $15 million home. In those instances, and they end up jacking up the price of houses, anyways. So it's just one of those sort of tax expenditures that is an easy sell and impossible to get rid of. And so that's the plan. When you hear get rid of loopholes, basically it's just a way of saying this we'll get rid of loopholes for, you know, anywhere from 6 to 18 months, and then they'll be back.
Exactly. And at the same time, they are inexplicably lowering tax rates. And they're saying this is, I don't understand why nobody questions this. I mean, it just seems to, you know, we've got to fix the deficit. Our grandkids are going to be drowning in debt. The, you know, the world's coming to an end. We've got a cliff, Armageddon, whatever. And they're lowering tax rates. I mean, how does this make sense? I mean, why aren't they at the least keeping the tax rates and closing the loopholes? Why, what's, where's the need to lower them? Now, there's a whole, you know, school of thought around, you know, what is it, broaden the base and lower the rates, you know, all this thing. It doesn't make any sense. In fact, it reminds me so much of the whole supply-side magical thinking.
That's what it
where,
is.
Where, gee, if we just lower tax rates, we'll bring in so much more money. This they and for them to get away with it a second time is just unbelievable. And yet here we are again. And everyone's, you know, I hear everybody from Andrea Mitchell to, you know, Dianne Feinstein to any number of other people just repeating that like it makes sense. Oh, well, we need to lower the rates in order to close the deficit. You know, what, huh?
What happens is when you lower people's tax rates, they have more money to spend on unicorn food. And everyone knows it's the unicorns running faster, which create more economic activity and
well,
thereby
yeah.
generate more revenue.
Of course. Of course. I keep forgetting about the unicorns but, and the magic ponies.
So this is all part of that. So we're going to, so as we enter into this, I mean, you know, the one thing that actually sort of gives me some hope is, well, there's two things. One is that even though we have this lame duck session from November to theoretically, I guess, more or less Christmas time, it's a very short period of time for these people to get their act together, which is why these CEOs and these new no labels are all trying to tee up stuff to make it really easy at that point. The other thing is that if Mitt Romney loses the election, I mean, if Mitt Romney wins the election, I mean, so and
oh, forget it. Yeah, we're dead.
None of this, all of these conversations are moot. Go directly to do not pass. Go directly to the worst case scenario on all of these things, because it would also indicate a. Republicans taking control of both houses, which is probably more than likely, even if President Obama is reelected. But if Mitt Romney loses, the reaction by the Republicans, of course, is going to be he was not conservative enough.
Yes.
And this could actually save us on almost all of these accords, it seems to me, because it's going to mean a hardening of the Republicans rather than a softening as I guess President Obama thinks and the sort of the conventional wisdom, which I don't know if they even believe it, but that's what they say. People don't realize that if Mitt Romney loses, that means the Republican Party moves even more to the right and becomes even more extreme because they are in their oppositional posture.
Oh, absolutely. You know, this was this is one of the, you know, the odd effects of them nominating a, you know, a so-called moderate, which, by the way, he, you know, I don't think he's anything, actually. I think he is whatever they tell him to be at this point. But, yes, of course, they will see him as, the ultimate betrayer of the conservative cause. I mean, they see everybody that way. They treat George Bush that way. And that guy was a real conservative. And you know that's I see a hardening as well. It's almost too bad. I had kind of wished it would be good for America if they had nominated a true hardcore conservative and the person, you know, a Goldwater type scenario, and the person lost, you know, absolutely without question. They would have to actually start reevaluating what they're doing, but they're not going to do that this time. They will definitely, I think, harden their position. And in a way, because the Democrats are so willing to, you know, go along with this conventional wisdom about the debt and what have you, even though think about the context. I mean, look at what's happening in Europe. How's that working out for them?
Right.
You know, let's do what they're doing. Okay. Great idea. Anyway, you know, I think the Democrats are, they may be willing to do some bargaining in a way that is not good for America. And once again, it may be that the Tea Party or the right wing of the Republican Party saves us. I mean, I hate to think this way. It's not good. There are many things. There are many, many things on the agenda that need to be dealt with. We have problems, big ones. and we can't even go near them. All we're doing at this point is trying to stop the bleeding, and these people are trying to bleed the patient. So, you know, we have that's the best we can do is fight them off, fight off the leeches, and try to keep them from making things worse. That's a terrible position to be in.
Yes.
But in a weird way, you know, the crazy people with the leeches, you know, they're mad because they're not putting enough leeches on, so they won't let them put any. You know, I'm
right.
Sorry, I'm extending this
idea
metaphor
being is that the Democrats, if the Republicans showed up with a couple leeches, the Democrats could probably sign on to that. But a buckets and,
right.
and dump truck full of leeches,
right.
then the Democrats are too embarrassed
yeah.
at that point to say,
right.
wait a second, you know, you've got a dump truck full of leeches. And so that's that. Let's leave on that note.
Right.
And
could
pray.
We just open one vein instead of, you know, all the leeches, because that's even too gross for us.
Pray that the Republicans show up with just more leeches than the mind can conceive of. And maybe we'll be safe.
Yeah.
It's
all this is sort of converged. I mean, some of it by design and some of it just by accident. I don't think all this, you know, all these things on the fiscal cliff. I mean, before we end this, just let me point out one more thing. There are two other things happening in the lame duck session. There's the end of the payroll tax cut and extended unemployment benefits.
Mm-hmm.
If it goes by the same scenario that it did last time, that the you know we're going to see a buildup of oh we've got to help the unemployed people this is terrible which we do I mean I'm not you know saying that but they'll use that'll be the hostage
right.
And I don't know they could throw in something else I mean I don't know what it would be I'm thinking maybe some you know immigration deal or something like that where you know they hold it over the heads of the liberals and say how could you do this to these poor people we need to do all these other things so you know keep an eye on those are the two things
that's the
you know,
bait for those people on
yeah.
the left I mean you know the interesting it's an interesting dilemma because obviously we have extended unemployment in this country now. None of our elites seem to want to address that issue, and they will throw this bone out there. The same with frankly, putting aside the meager stimulative effects of tax cuts. I would just assume allow that moratorium on the Social Security taxes to essentially expire and you know then deal with the problem that we need to fix the economy come the 2013 the spring. I mean the only thing that I think would create less urgency on behalf of the Democrats to extend that moratorium is that they're now at the very least House is 2.5 years away from the next election
right.
and the Senate and the president will not have another election. And so maybe they will really make a genuine attempt to stimulate the economy in a sort of less clandestine way rather than these sort of not even eighth measures that they take that ultimately end up being bigger excuses to cut, our social insurance programs.
Yeah. Well, you know, from your lips, I mean, that's the best case scenario there that, you know, somehow or another, this whole thing shakes out. I mean, this, you know, I'm always kind of, you know, I'm writing pray for gridlock, but it's only because, you know, I just think we have to stop what both parties are trying to do, and gridlock is the only way we can do it. But, you know, in reality, there are things that we could do
right.
to help this economy, and it would be really, really great if we could do that. And, you know, it's possible that somehow this whole thing, you know, the fever could break. Maybe the expiration of the Bush tax cuts and the idea of the replacement of the Obama tax cuts, that seems like a pretty shocking thing to me, shocking to the entire system of the political establishment, to have them come in and put on the table middle-class tax cuts. And, you know, and I should say, there's a lot of people out there who think that we should let both of those tax cuts expire.
I'm one of them.
Because, you know,
and I
on a theoretical basis, I don't have a problem with that. But I think that the economy is dicey
right.
enough that having middle-class tax hikes at this point is probably not the greatest idea. I just feel like, you know, and I'm not saying it just on a political level. I think even on an economic level, we might
extend
keep playing
them for
with
another
fire
2 years,
there.
Let's say.
Yeah, do something like that and keep fighting over middle class tax cuts, you know what I mean? Instead of, you know, well, I mean, that's always a good, you know, when the time comes, you know, I think, you know, we'll be able to deal with that a little bit more efficiently. And I could be wrong about that, but I, you know, I just feel like that's better terrain for the Democrats. But maybe that will break the fever. I don't know. I mean, you've got this entire group of elites, both government and financial and business elites, who are seemingly determined to do this thing. And,
well,
you know,
they smell
all you have to do
it.
Is
they
look
smell
at
the opportunity, and this could be one of their best opportunities. And I think that's why they're so determined. They see this lame duck session as a field of gold for them. And well, I'm not going to carry out the metaphor, but it will. They want to shower us with gold, as it were.
Thanks a lot.
Well, all right, Digby. Maybe next time we've got to pre-tape these things, because every time we talk, I want to go have a drink, and it's just
yeah, absolutely.
At
Let's
least
do
it's
that
past noon on the East Coast. You're going to have to wait a couple hours.
We'll drink while we're doing it. You know, that might actually help.
Yes. Digby from the blog Hullabaloo at digbysblog.blogspot.com. Always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sam.
All
Bye-bye.
Right, folks. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Mitt Romney's ad. This is one of my favorite ads of the year because, one, it's got a guy with a heavy Massachusetts accent, although I think New Hampshire, New England accent. And, two, he's, you know, sort of lying through his teeth, or maybe not so much lying, but you know what I'm saying. And we'll also, we got a bunch of other stories, SB 1070 racist emails. Oh, God, it's just so wonderful. What is today Monday? It feel Oh, no. All right, well, it's Tuesday. So much closer to when it's appropriate to drink earlier in the day. Folks, speaking of drinks, they don't pay for themselves. And as such, I need you to become a member of the Majority Report. Nothing goes better with your drinking in the middle of the afternoon than a membership to the Majority Report. You can become a member today at majority.fm. It is your support that keeps this show alive, that will keep it alive going forward in the future. No institutional support. Oh, I will also talk about the 10:30 a.m. Forum out in Seattle. I mixed it up a little bit with some of my fellow progressive hosts. But it is the fact that you people support this program that allows me a little more freedom, in my estimation, as to what I can talk about. And, you know, I have essentially one boss. It is the hive mind of the membership of Majority.fm. And because it's a hive mind, I don't have to listen to any particular bee, although I listen to the buzzes of everyone. But no one bee can control what we do. And it's a great model. Allow me to continue it, please, by becoming a member today at majority.fm. A lot of other ways to support the show. You can go to majority.fm/support the show. You can buy merch. Every time you go to justcoffee.coop and buy a bag of Majority FM blend using the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Mark Maron gets chopped down just a little bit. I don't know if you saw that tweet where he said he bought a bag of it and it was bitter. And I responded that perhaps he should find something more dense to filter it with, like his self-awareness. It gets ugly out there, folks. So go to justcoffee.coop, buy fair trade coffee, buy the Majority blend, show Mark Maron who's boss, metaphorically speaking, and of course in a very, very limited way. if you buy crap through Amazon, make sure you buy it through our link, people. We get a little kickback. You can find that at majority.fm/support the show. Click on it. Bookmark it. Bookmark it as Amazon. You won't know the difference. Go there always when you buy your Amazon stuff. We get a kickback. We got merch. We're always looking for iTunes reviews. You want to, we have YouTube videos. Repost them around the web. Do you have a Reddit account? Post our videos. You got an account at Daily Kos or Democratic Underground? Post our videos. Do you have friends and neighbors? Post them on Facebook. We could do it automatically for you. Just go to donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. Give us one post a day. You'll become the talk of your Facebook networks or whatever, friends circles. So there's a lot of different ways you can support the program. I hope that you will. Want to be a part of this program? Call in 646-257-3920 or IM me at Majority FM. I got a new account so that you can IM us from just about anywhere using majorityfm@jabber.org. Just put in a request there through your IM system. All right, folks, see you in the better half.